The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Before getting stuck into the Zap to the Past podcast, please accept our apologies. The audio quality on this episode only is a little bit lacking, and that's because the microphone was damaged when we recorded it. We've done our best to clean up the audio, and we hope it doesn't mar your enjoyment, but it won't happen again. Also, sometimes we refer to an episode zero. What is episode zero? That was the pilot episode of the podcast. That's something that we talk about in these episodes, but has yet to be released, and we intend to release that episode in the future. Until then, enjoy episode one of Zap to the Past.
Hello and welcome to episode one of Zapped to the Past. My name is Adrian Mills and I am joined as ever by my good friend and co-host Graham Raddings. In case you don't know, this is a podcast that focuses primarily on games that were released for the Commodore 64, but we're also going to take a brief look at what was going on in the UK back in the 1980s. There were thousands of games released for the Commodore 64, so to bring order to this chaos, we are using the magazine Zap 64 as a monthly guide for the games to focus on. Just one last thing regarding that though, I'd hasten to add that we are in no way affiliated with the magazine Zap 64 itself. So what was Zap 64? Just so to give a brief bit of history to that. It was a sister magazine to the Spectrum-focused Crash and was something of a sea change in homegrown magazines when it launched in May 1985. It did away with long, dull typing games and brought a more personality-focused level of coverage to the Commodore 64 scene. For myself and friends, it quickly replaced magazines like Computer and Video Games and Commodore User as the go-to place for definitive reviews, previews, news, and all things Commodore 64. One last thing, please, to note is that there are a couple of swear words that do crop up every now and again. We're not the sweariest of podcasts, I have to say, but there is the odd little one that does slip through in the heat of the moment. It's nothing major, but if it is an issue, then obviously please be warned that the odd one will slip through. So, in this episode, we'll be looking at the games reviewed in the first issue of Zap 64, which was the rather dull and wet month of May 1985. Graham, what exactly can we expect in this episode?
In today's episode, we're going to take a look at Elite, decide whether it's just a load of empty space. We're going to look at Airwolf and Pole Position. We're also going to dive into Turn Enog, see if it's worth turning it on or turning it off. And we even look at the Eurovision Song Contest and whether Bobby Sox should have been the winner. All of that to come.
So Zap did actually launch with a relatively big game review. This was a huge title across numerous platforms, so much so that it made the cover. It was their cover game. We could go on about covers for Zap 64. The late great Oliver Frey, who did some incredible artwork throughout Zap and Crash and Amtix and all the magazines that ran for out of there. Was it Newsfield? It was Newsfield that did Zap, wasn't it? Yeah, Newsfield. It would be hard pushed to sort. This was a great game for him to get his teeth into from what you could actually do for it visually. And of course, we're talking about Elite. So Elite, one of video game's sacred cows, do we think?
Yes, I think you're right. Well, at that time, it was the revered game, wasn't it? Because it had that. And it also came, it was, I mean, its legacy is odd. It came from like the BBC Micro, right? So And that was kind of its legacy stone. That was kind of a serious computer, right? BBC Micro. It was the school computer. They was all in school, so it must have been kind of serious.
Had a big forehead, I always thought, BBC Micro.
It was an elongated machine, wasn't it, with clacky keys. I remember the clacky... that's kind of what we had one in the whole school when I was a nipper. I don't remember playing Elite on it, though.
No, it just shows you
what schools knew.
Draw line, I think, was the command.
Yeah, I must have done the old 10 print, 20 go to 10 a million times. Call myself a programmer, then.
Well, you programmed. So Elite. All right, let's get this out of the way, sort of thing. I've never been a big fan of Elite. I just haven't. I find... And this is not to denigrate the technical aspects of it. You know, what Braben and Bell managed to squeeze into these, you know, 8-bit machines, 32K, 48K, 64K, whatever, is incredible. Don't get me wrong. You know, entire galaxy, loads of planets, everything that goes into Elite, yes, incredible. But the C64 version, obviously the version we're talking about and the thing I played, just slow and a bit boring. I've never been able to get on with it. Not ever. And I feel like I'm going against the grain. You know, people, you can't talk bad about Elite, but, you know, from a gameplay point of view, it is very dull. There's just nothing really to do. It's not responsive. It's not particularly interesting. You fly from place to place. You trade in slaves. You trade in this. And there's a load of freedom. I get all these things. But, and, you know, user-created stories, and, you know, people have all these great... you know, anecdotes about it, and yeah, that's fine, but I just feel there's not much game there. There's not much, I don't know how to express it. It's just lacking a hook.
Yeah, I mean, the question you have to ask yourself, I suppose, when you think about it is, you mean you didn't find intergalactic space trading interesting at a young age?
Well, space is dull. You know, trying to control something in space, and also... Don't even get me started, and this will be probably to a lot of people, docking at that very first space station before you've got a docking computer. trying to match your rotation to that small square that's getting bigger and bigger until crash. Bang, game over. Commander Jameson, you are dead.
Yeah, I completely agree. It is classic frustration point. As if starting with very little wasn't bad enough in a spaceship that's ill-equipped for space travel, let alone battles. You've then got to dock this thing. Now, I would challenge anyone, even right now, get an astronaut, put him in front of that game, in the front of the C64 game, and say, right, you've got to dock on that slow-moving rectangle, which is going to speed up as it gets bigger because the maths is getting simpler. And then you've got to align yourself to that. It was frustrating. And how many times did you crash and kill yourself doing that, thinking, right, well, I went through all the rigmarole of loading up my spaceship with various spices to trade with, you know, Dizzo from my planet of Lave, only to be destroyed trying to land. I mean, only when you get the docking computer by either hook nor crook later does it become a one-button thing where it just automatically guides you. Why didn't it just give you that from the start?
Yeah, exactly. You know, did they not watch in Star Wars, the Millennium Falcon just glides in? You know, into the Death Star, it just glides in because they get it in a tractor beam and they pull it in. Why could they, you know, they've already got it programmed, they've got a docking computer in there, give you that from the start, do away with so much frustration. I might even like this game because I might feel that I can actually do stuff and not have to worry about, am I going to crash into this thing?
In all fairness, if you're the administrator boss of the docking bay of a significantly proportioned space terminal, you do not want people just flying in with no credentials, willy-nilly just crashing into your mothership and crashing into your dock and your docking bay and trashing the place without, you know, just give them the computer. You're going to save yourself thousands of millions of dollars in bent metal costs. I'm speaking from an insurance point of view. You know, just if you're going to operate a space station, the last thing you want is a free-for-all of people crashing into the dock. Just give them away. Give space. Look, if you want to come in, I'll give you a docking computer. Don't worry about it.
And something that size as well is going to create a bit of centrifuge, I'd have thought. So I imagine, sort of thing, it's going to be like Saturn's ring, but just this crash spaceship debris going around it after a while.
Yeah. And don't even get me started on the combat in that stupid game. Who invented instead of going left and right, rotating all the time? you know, rotate, you know, why would you? I mean, I know it's based and it's, you know, but, and there's this, and that's my chief complaint with this game is because there's a predilection in this game to kind of follow the space rules of gravity and all of those sort of things. And that's all very admirable. It's all very 2001. The problem there is it's not very exciting. No, it's nothing worse than, I mean, if they actually showed a space battle of mine from that game in like a movie like Star Wars, they'd just see me spinning round, rotating endlessly and finding my only solace is that the planet is round enough for me mm-hmm. to focus on it for 2 seconds, but I'll spin out of control again. And it's like, that's not exciting. And then I have lasers that aren't powerful enough to do any damage. It was all reputation. And it is a programming feat to fit a universe inside of a 32K BBC, let alone a 64K. And apparently the Commodore 64 version had added extras that they did other versions didn't have. So it was like the best version in terms of what was in it. But I don't know, it's not for me, Elite. And even then, you know, there's been iterations and iterations and iterations of it. Vector Graphics was not a Commodore 64 strong point. It didn't have as fast a processor as the BBC in terms of its CPU capability. And it showed. In games where there was a lot of Vector Graphics and mathematical drawing, it showed and it made it lag. And even back then, yeah, I just found it initially, it had that kind of, wow, a big galaxy that I can explore. What it is actually is generally just following circles.
Yeah,
around I
do remember, you know, asking myself, was the problem me? You know, I must be missing something here. There must be something because, you know, like it's Zap gold medal. It's got this reputation. It's this incredible piece of programming and this incredible game and an entire galaxy at your fingertips. And so the problem must be me. It must be me. But then I've, you know, over the years, I've come to realize that, no, the problem isn't me. The problem is just that it's just dull and it's just not for me. It's not for me. I'm not knocking it in any way, shape, or form, other than it's not for me, and I just don't get on with it.
Well, they properly like gave it a great review in Zap, and I just couldn't, you read the review and it's very evangelical about it, and I just couldn't comprehend the game I played and their review, and so I just came to the conclusion that contextually at that time, that kind of 3D must have been nigh on impossible outside of an arcade, and so on a computer, they must have been overly impressed by that. But you know, you knew that as soon as you started that game, you were going backwards and forwards from bloody Dizzo to Lave, endlessly trading in the most inane stuff, and then when you did finally get the money to trade something exciting, you got shot down by the police anyway. Bah, to Elite.
So there you go. We're not.
So we liked it.
Let's start as we mean to go on.
Okay.
Because
yeah.
Next up, so that's Elite. We didn't like it. We didn't. So,
less
sorry.
Than Elite. Sorry. I feel bad to say it as well.
Yeah, it is because it does have that reputation. It lasts. You know, there's Elite Dangerous out now and everything, and people still play it, and it's got this. You know, it's the sacred cow. Onwards, from the whole world to a single piece of road and maybe some water. Spy Hunter was reviewed in this issue of the C64 version of the arcade classic. I don't know, it's an arcade game. You know, so it's got a good reputation, I guess. C64 version, probably not. Probably not.
I don't know.
My comments, my notes were a rudimentary conversion with twitchy controls and a bit dull. You know?
Yeah. Well,
I found the controls very twitchy.
Yes.
You know, and quite hard, and I would just bounce off stuff and die, and I was like, ugh. It's okay. It's rudimentary. I don't know. I think maybe it's okay. Spy Hunter is a good game. I used to like playing it in the arcade sort of thing. I think the problem I had with it was that the aspect ratio in the arcade, it's very long, very tall, so you could see a lot more of the road.
Yes. Yes, it was.
And this, not so much. So
yeah,
you were reacting
I think you're right.
A bit late.
Yeah, it's
and
a
I
bit
think
squashed.
That yeah, and, you know, it's got, I mean, it, to be fair, it has all the elements of the arcade game, it's all there. It's, you know, it scrolls nicely. It looks, it's recognizable. I don't know. I feel like I'm dying with faint praise here.
Yeah. it says the word spy hunter when it starts. That's a good start.
It does, yeah, but I can't get excited about this conversion. Nothing about it made me go, yeah, I want to play more of this. In fact, everything about it made me, I don't want to play any more of this. So, yeah.
Well, the problem with Spy Hunter is that it's Spy Hunter. So, contextually, this is a driving game with a bit of a kind of a James Bond sort of hint, I think.
Yeah, yeah. You actually described the game because I haven't, so you go for it.
Well, essentially, from what I can gather, I mean, you're not really given much to go by. You are a guy driving a car. It looks like a kind of a Bond, James Bond style car. But I assume if you're a spy hunter, that would mean that you're the person who's hunting James Bond. So you technically must be the bad guy, I think. Anyway, so you're driving a car along the road, and the premise, from what I can gather, is to simply survive the road. And to do that, you have to keep ramming vehicles off the road, but not the certain vehicles. There's certain enemy types that you can't do that to, and I think that's it. I think at a certain point you change to a boat for some reason, and then you can change back to a car. There is a nice little upgrade sort of tree where you can drive into the back of a lorry, and you can pick up missiles on oil slicks and stuff like that. That's as an arcade conversion. In terms of the functional aspects of the arcade and what it did, they're all there. You can drive, you can get in boats, you can ram things, you can get into the vans and into the lorries and get an upgrade and all that kind of thing. But the trouble with the game is, as much as that simple gameplay, that's it. And it is super repetitive. And the issue with the C64 version is sparse. It's just very sparse. There's not many vehicles in it. Yeah. It's kind of, instead of it being a crowded, busy road where you're trying to navigate your way through lots of traffic, it's kind of like a leisurely drive in the countryside with the occasional Volkswagen Beetle getting in your way. I mean, I've driven that way. I've never ram on off the road. But the idea of hunting spies doesn't come across in the sort of jaunty...
That's something that's never occurred to me.
...happy version. And, you know, there's no urgency to it. It's just kind of a casual drive, periodically interrupted by either a car with spikes or you can explode for no reason in that game.
Yes. This is more sort of Roger Moore in A View to a Kill versus the arcade version, which is Daniel Craig in Casino Royale.
Yeah, I remember the arcade game had that. It was a sit-down arcade, which was unusual at the time. And it wasn't a steering wheel. It was kind of a... if you imagine a letter M with like a handlebar, the steering wheel was that. So, and you had an accelerator pedal in it, which was, I think, one of the first games to feature that kind of control. So the arcade had that innovative... value. You take all that away and you're just kind of left with a pretty repetitive game. And the graphics are very sparse, very basic on that. For a Commodore 64 that can display a lot more sprites than that, even at a most basic level, without the complexity of doing some of the fancy programming that came later, they could have had more in that screen, and I'd felt that it was just a bit empty.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it's never occurred to me, actually, that, yeah, why are you hunting spies?
Yeah. You're the spy hunter.
The title has never occurred to me. Are you the bad... It's like, are we the bad guys? Are we hunting James Bond? Because James Bond doesn't hunt other spies.
Yeah, and as a final note, the Peter Gunn theme, which is in that, actually emulates the arcade pretty much perfectly. It's the only thing in it that is as close to the arcade as most of the things I've heard. And that's not good, though. It's not saying that's great, because as much as it's Peter Gunn, it's A, repetitive, and B, really quiet in the background. The engine sounds and the skid sounds of the vehicles aren't good. So, you know, as much as it's got these token tertiary effects, that Peter Gunn theme, albeit inaudible, almost, is straight from the arcade. But, well, no, it's
confused.
What is it? It's not particularly complex, is it? Anyway, Spy Hunter is dull, endless, repetitive.
Mm-hmm.
By hunting.
No, it is like I said, it's a rudimentary conversion. It's recognizable as Spy Hunter, but take away all the trappings of the arcade and it's actually lays bare that it's not that interesting, I think. So we're off to a good start, and things only, well, do they get better? I don't know, probably not. Two for two, really. So we've got another arcade conversion coming up. And that is another car game, strangely enough. And it's, again, a bit of another classic that is reviewed in this issue. And that is Pole Position. Now, for those who don't know, Pole position is based on Formula One, I guess. You're driving a Formula One car around a track. It was a classic arcade game from Atari. It was very good in the arcade sort of thing. Nice, clear, crisp graphics, lots of speed, good sense of 3D, sprite scaling and all that kind of thing. But then you have the C64 version. And if you thought Spy Hunter had bad handling, then Pole Position basically just says hold my beer and walks off. And awful handling. Like, there's no sense of grip, physics, anything. I didn't know what was going on. And the cars seemingly made out of C4. Because I can only think that that is the case, because you touch anything and you are a ball of flame. Literally, the whole car is gone, sort of thing. This is literally, you know, brush a pebble, a stone, bounce off the back of another car, and your car is just a flaming sprite.
Well, that's right. I mean, who knew that Formula One cars were so volatile? I mean, you breathe on those things, they explode in that game, right?
Yeah, it's awful. And you know, what the note I've made on this, aside from just the word no, was in a world where Pit Stop 2 exists, why would you play this?
Yes. Playing on its reputation from the arcade.
Yeah. And like Spy Hunter before it, the music's not a bad representation of the arcade music. And that's quite iconic. That stuck in my head. And I was like, when you hear that music and he starts, you're thinking, oh, this is actually going to be okay. Because that music instantly transitions you to the arcade version. You're thinking, I know that. I like Pole Position in the arcade. I've had some good plays of that. And then it starts. And, you know, it's like just someone setting that memory on fire.
You're exactly right. Again, this is, another arcade conversion that relies on the fact that the original had a steering wheel and pedal. And a sit-down driving position. Take that away, and you're left with driving a car with a stick, which isn't easy in any capacity. But even if that was something that you could look past, my two words that I wrote down initially were somewhat horrific. Because it's just, as an arcade conversion, all the things that you'd want out of an arcade conversion are not there. The road is inexplicably bendy. The steering doesn't seem to. It could steer itself around some of the bends. But when they went really steep, it just kind of, the road didn't bend as much as kind of curve in a really weird way. And then if you then turned your vehicle, the animation of the hugely blocky, and actually stupidly blocky sprite, unnecessarily blocky sprite, really lazy programming, really that, went really sort of elongated. So, and then all of a sudden you would shoot across the track at 100 mile an hour, boom, explode. I'm like, but you would come back immediately. And then obviously the kicker is that you start then in low gear and you have to go to high gear, which is essentially just a way of changing drone sound from annoying to really annoying. and then I just thought, you know, in a world where you've got Pit Stop 2, as you rightly point out, why on earth would anybody in their right mind pay money for that? And I think the retail was well over £6 or £7 at this point, which is a lot of money back then.
Yep. Yeah, dreadful.
It's an arcade cash-in at the end of the day, and Sad that, I mean, there was a lot of them at that time, actually. There's a few. We'll no doubt come across all of these as we go through the Zap magazines, but this was a particularly, you know, there's two real doozies there, Spy Hunter and Pole Position, which, great arcade games, not great conversions.
No, they weren't. And it's a shame sort of thing, but like I said, you know, Pit Stop 2 exists, and so what do I care about Pole Position? You know, that's simply it. And, Pit Stop 2 showed that you could have clear, crisp car graphics, nice track, good handling, and everything that entailed, and this doesn't have any of that, and it's an arcade cash-in grab. Airwolf is our next one, so let's move away from cars and let's move to helicopters. Airwolf. We're just controlling a lot of vehicles at the moment. We've got spaceships, cars, and now helicopters. Airwolf was, for those who don't know, it's a TV show from the 1980s in which a man called Stringfellow Hawk flew a prototype helicopter in, you know, a week-to-week serial, went on adventures, rescued people from missions given him by a guy called Archangel, if I remember rightly, whilst Ernest Borgnine just smiled from the sidelines.
Sorry, it's Dominic Santini you're referring to there.
Dominic Santini, sorry.
That's his character name, Dominic Santini.
I love these names. Stringfellow Hawk, Dominic Santini, and Archangel. they were on fire whenever they wrote that. They would go off, they would fly around, maybe shoot some stuff, rescue people and do whatever sort of thing. Week to week, serial adventures, a la Blue Thunder, A-Team, Knight Rider, a whole slew of these that came through in the 80s. Airwolf the Game. I don't remember Airwolf being in a caves with bouncing faces.
There was a...
I don't remember that from the TV show. I must have missed that episode.
It was the when Stringfellow drank from the wrong bottle that time. And Archangel said, not that bottle. Oh, no. No. Right.
So this is Airwolf the Hallucinator.
Exactly. Yeah. No, for the next 2 hours, Stringfellow, don't fly a helicopter, mate, because you are going to see things. It was like
you're going to see the same. You're going to see the same little bit of cave over and over while you try and control this helicopter. Yeah. That is an absolute nightmare.
Which suffers from a mad problem.
Go on.
It suffers from a serious technical flaw in that it can't hover. All helicopters can hover, as far as I'm aware. But not that one. No.
No. This was, I don't know. Yeah, and so. The game starts you off in a very... You're quite a large sprite, and the Airwolf sprite is actually quite nice. I'll give it that. The Airwolf sprite is all right, okay? And similar... I thought this was a bit of an evolution of Choplifter that we talked about last time, in that your helicopter could face left, face right, and face on, sort of thing. So you could drop bombs, and you could shoot left, right, and center, and you have to fly around. So the game starts you off, and it's very... You're quite a chunky sprite. Not chunky as in chunky, but a fairly big sprite. And you're in this very, very tight cave area... where this, for some reason, this object is pinging between three magnets. I don't know what they were, like, or pinball bumpers or something, for no reason. And so you have to get in a particular place to shoot this object. I could only get it if I went over to the other side, turned left, hoping I didn't fly into anything, and then I could manage to shoot it. That opened a door, the door was only open... Very, very narrow, not much bigger than you, so the twitchy controls, the fact you can't hover, made it very hard to get through that door. If you got through that door, you were faced with, I think if I remember, a brick wall. You had to shoot your way through this brick wall, and then what looked like the liquor sprites from Iridis Alpha, these faces were just floating around, and by this point you were dead. And they were back to you were back to the title screen and had to do all that again. And that's sad to say, I didn't get any further because when they drew up the design document for this, when that's the episode of Airwolf we're going to base this on. If they'd have made this a version of Choplifter, I could have probably got behind it. Because Airwolf rescuing people, flying around, shooting stuff, Choplifter, I can see that. I applaud their wanting to do something different, but Airwolf's adventures in caves is not what I wanted.
Yeah, and as a final note, yeah, it was. And as a final note, just one thing I had was that the music, which was... Airwolf was really famous for its main TV music score. It was a really great theme tune. It was a really oddly jaunty version in the game. It kind of felt like, you know, Steel Ice Span had got hold of it and gone, oh, we'll record that for you. Don't you worry about that. And come up with this kind of hey, nonny, nonny version of the Airwolf theme. And I know there was many Airwolf themes that came out in different ways at that time from different composers as part of the whole kind of C64 demo thing, which we'll cover in many episodes' time. But suffice to say, it wasn't a great version of the theme, which is odd because it's almost built for synthesizers like the C64 could have emulated. It could have done so much better with that.
So this is not going well. We haven't played a good game yet. Or a game that we've enjoyed. Is that going to change? I don't know. Is this going to change? Maybe. I don't know. Let's see. What did you think to our next game? So we've got a couple more before we go for a break. If you're wondering why we're covering these games, they got high review scores. So we're covering them these are the big hitters. We're not got to the bad games yet. So stay with us. Stay with us, because it only goes downhill. Or maybe uphill. Who knows? So our next game is Shadowfire. Shadowfire, made by, released by Beyond Software, designed by Denton Designs, I think it was at the time, is an odd game. It's in some ways quite ahead of its time. It's icon driven, sort of turn based strategy thing, where you control a team of sort of intergalactic adventurers, and you have to equip them with various equipment, laser blasters and all kinds of things, and control them through a space station through these icons. And this was unheard of back then. You know, icons, you know, weren't a thing in computing. Not really, not at this point in time. Especially, and they weren't in games. Really. I can think of very few games that used this, even over the period of time that C64 went on. And it's really unusual, and it boots up and it has some really unusual options. The first thing that springs to mind is really good music. Fred Gray, I think it was. And you can tell it's Fred Gray, I think. It sounds like Mission AD. Very, very similar style to his piece for Mission AD, and really good music. So from the get-go, there's a nice atmosphere about it. It looks great. The visuals are really nice. They look swish. They look unusual for the time. It's got a really unusual look to it. It opens up with a load of options, which include keys, normal joystick, also an analog joystick, and a light pen, which I thought was weird. I can see that a light pen would have been really good for the game, really good, because everything about it looks great, but controlling it with a joystick is where it falls down. It's a great idea that I think is ahead of its time. This would be great on something like the Game Boy Advance, on the DS with its touchscreen. Be awesome. You know, this game would be brilliant because you could flip between those menus really quick, and there's probably loads of games that do this. But you know, we're talking 1985 here, and I don't think the technology, I imagine a light pen where you could tap them would have been really good, but it was just so fiddly to do anything. And I went and hunted down the manual online and sort of had a look at what the controls were and what all the icons meant and tried to follow it through, and it actually gives you a step-by-step guide of how to get into it. And even then it was like, this is just far too fiddly. Maybe in 1985 I'd have had the time to really stick with it. But as it is right now, you know, going back, going forward, just menu to menu, with a joystick from icon to icon, it just killed the pace, which had been set up with this lovely visual design and great music, but the actual controls just killed it dead, which is a real shame because I really, really want to like this. Because I think it really stands out. It's one of the standout games we'll talk about today, I think. Just from the way it looks and what it's trying to do, but it just... that interface.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I mean, I found the game a bit impenetrable because of that. It's amazing to look at for its time. Very colourful, very pretty graphics. It was really great music. It was very different to anything else, which is always something I admire, you know, because it's the arcade conversions and the things that we've looked at so far, albeit with the exception of, you know, there was a licensed tie-in, a couple of arcade conversions and an intergalactic space game, you know, which we've covered. Shadowfire is different to them. It looks different. It plays differently. It is kind of, you know, Windows icons and menus driven. And that is really unusual for it's a turn-based sort of adventure game. And so it's a sort of the next logical step from a text adventure and that kind of graphic adventure, and where you're managing a team and you've got the resources and everything else. And if you like that kind of game, and you're willing to persevere with the control system, and you put in the time that it would take, I imagine you probably get a lot more out of it than I did. I just found it pretty, but a bit impenetrable, bearing in mind that I had no idea what I was doing. So, and I did try and look up the instructions as they were. I got a flavour of what you were meant to do. But I have to say, that kind of character control... adventure type games, they just bore me generally. I'm not a fan of that kind of game. So I'm not willing to put in the extra time it takes to persevere with something. I've never really got on with games, and there'll be loads more games that we cover that sort of resemble Shadowfire as we go on. There's a few games that sort of start to lean into that, and in the end, actually, if you look at the kind of the trajectory of where those games go, you end up at things like Command and Conquer and things like that further down the line, many years down the line. But an initial game of this type, it's very unusual. It is pretty. It's impenetrable to somebody anyway, a little bit without the willingness to put in the time and investment. But also, you have to really like that kind of game, and it's no criticism to the people who made it, because it's a big game in terms of its scope. It just wasn't for me. But that said, I love the graphics on that. I'm a sucker for really nice drawn pixel graphics, and it did have that. It's got that in Bucket, so it's certainly better than the previous four games by a mile. Later down the line, when we start to look at the Lucasfilm games for the C64, where they use the Scrum adventure system, where the formula for that kind of point and click becomes very, very clear, at this point, they're just missing one element, which is kind of that graphical sort of window at the top where you can see the characters doing stuff. If you imagine Shadowfire with that, it would have been a wholly different experience and probably a lot higher rated than it is.
Well, I think that's the sequel, isn't it? Enigma Force.
Well, yeah, well, we'll come to that.
We will come to that. But I also think as well that you hit on a good point there, sort of thing, in the fact of the Lucasfilm games. I mean, they allowed you time to sort of, the interface felt, okay, bit slow, bit clunky. This gives you 100 minutes. There's a timer clock counting down from the get-go. As soon as you start, the clock going down. From 99 minutes and 59 seconds, and it's going down all the time, which, yes, adds pace, I think, but when the interface is so clunky, you feel like you're fighting, you're not being able to do stuff fast enough. And I think that if you'd have had a bit more time, and it maybe it'd have been properly turn-based, like, okay, plan your move, and now it happens, I'd have felt it would have worked better.
No, I agree.
It's an interesting experiment, and I think it's worth a look because you may really get on with it.
And the music is great in that game. It is. It's Fred Gray doing what Fred Gray does. It's a classic.
Yeah. Presentationally, it's the best of the bunch so far by a country mile. From the highs of Shadowfire to the Trudgery of Turn-A-Nog. I think trudgery is a good word. I'll just read my notes because I think that this speaks to it, but awkward and bewildering.
Which is not a review you ever want.
Kept getting killed by a monkey. Nice main character, but dull. Turn-A-Nog.
Yes.
Turn-A-Nog is an old style arcade adventure, shall we say. You you control this with the most awkward control systems known to man. I don't know why I've no idea why they chose it. We'll come to this in a minute, but it's a terrible, terrible control system. And what you can do is you see your character, the titular, I don't know what he's called, if he's called Mr. Turn-A-Nog. I know, is it Mr. Nog?
Oi, Noggy!
I don't know, what's his name?
I don't know, has he got one?
Mr. Nanog?
Turn-A-Nog's a place. Yeah.
Oh, is it, sort of thing? So what's his name?
I don't know.
Is it Kulkhead or something?
Like that.
I think something like that. Anyway, you control this guy, this looks like someone who sort of plays in what they call Manor War. or something like that. So this is a character that plays in some dodgy metal band. He's got no top on, just some black trousers and long hair.
I think we've met a few people.
And you control him. You control him with this awkward control system, and you can walk left, or you can walk right one step, or you can set it to auto walk. You can flip the screen left 90 degrees each way to reveal things in the background or things in the as a mapping exercise. It's I don't know, I felt like I'd need a brain like Escher to try and get my head around this, because I couldn't, it was so bewildering. I was just, and then every now and again sort of thing, it just kept coming up with some Celtic word up on the thing, and then the monkey appeared and killed me. I did pick up an axe at one point and try to attack it, but the attack animation was so slow, and I just stood there with an axe held out for a time, and then the monkey walked past it and killed me again. I had no idea what was going on. Supposedly, it told me that I had to find these 5 artifacts, which I went off to find down these bewildering series of lanes to walk along. And to come to the control system, if I remember rightly, gives you multiple keys to use, but you've got some options. You've got A and S, I think, is walk left and right. Z and X is spin the camera around. And Q and W is use and drop, I think. And then you can pick up more than one items and use the number keys for that. So...
the sound of exasperation.
Turn a knob. That's it. That's all I can say yes. about this. It's well animated. Give that sort of thing. It shows its Spectrum heritage. It looks like a Spectrum game. You know, it's very, very sparse in its colours. You know, it's either yellow or green or blue background with black outline for the sprites. So it definitely shows its, you know, its minimal use of trying to avoid colour clash on the Spectrum. It shows its heritage in that respect. People probably obviously liked it at the time sort of thing, but going back to it now, it's awkward controls, it's bewildering interface, it's you know, all over the place mapping, which probably at the time was probably quite clever, but now it's just, I couldn't, no, not for
no.
me.
The key problem I felt with this for me was this was clearly a Spectrum, the Sinclair Spectrum port done because it was on the Spectrum and therefore you needed a Commodore 64 version. It was revered and well loved on the Sinclair Spectrum because it, you know, and in essence the game is an enormous you know, find the stuff adventure. And there was a lot of games of that type on the Sinclair Spectrum, find the stuff. You know, even if you look at things like Saberwolf and Attic Attack, and they're not in any of the. There's a number of games where you've just got to wander around going left and right, or in this case, left and right, up, down. Who knows what direction you were going because it's impossible to know. and just finding stuff and then piecing the stuff together, and then that stuff would, once you pieced it together, would reveal more stuff, and hey presto, you know, you've won the game somehow. My problem with it was that I'd already lost interest within the first 10 minutes of the first walk. Great. Is it great animation? It just felt like I was looking at a really bad Sinclair Spectrum port on a Commodore 64. We're knowing full well that the Commodore 64 is graphically and aurally and in every other way more capable than a Sinclair Spectrum. I know it's a controversial point, but it is. It's got more memory. There's no denying that. And it's got a graphic chip and a sound chip that can do stuff. The Z80... powered Sinclair Spectrum, while it had its merits, didn't have those things. And so this game could have been something completely different. But instead, they just literally made a screen-for-screen port of a Spectrum game badly. And even the parallax scrolling, which is there, it's juddery, it's ineffective. It's because it's a port, you know. I mean, it's almost a screen-for-screen port. And I found that quite difficult to comprehend. When you look at the kind of colourful graphics in a game like Shadowfire and some of the other games, albeit that Airwolf might have not been a great game, the graphics were quite good. So there's the capacity to have good graphics in a game. It didn't have to be this kind of monaural blue, black, yellow, black, green, black, bi-coloured backgrounds and, you know, monochromatic styles. And the sound effects in it were kind of token pings and pongs, and there was nothing really to draw me into this game. And if you're going to take me on an enormous adventure, and I can only assume that this, if it's Turn and Nog, which is kind of I think it's an almost Irish sort of Celtic folk, I hate to say it's Irish and Celtic, but kind of folklore kind of place. And I only know that because it's mentioned very briefly in the film Titanic before the woman and the 2 children drown. And she's...
Is that when they go down to the Irish...
No, they go to... you want a real party, you come to the Irish party. No, not that bit.
Don't do that.
The Irish, not that bad. No, although they do speak in that kind of way. Ironically, it's mother from the Terminator 2 movies who kills the guy with the milk carton in a different role. Obviously, she's not inexplicably time traveled into the Titanic and talking to her 2 kids because obviously they're trapped in the steerage section and it's flooding. And that's Titanic. But the long and the short of it was that's how I know that Tiernanog is some kind of mythical place for Irish people, or at least some people who believe in Turn and Nog. How that ties into this game, I don't know. I didn't get that far into it because I just kept, I couldn't stop him walking left. For seemingly, I couldn't turn right. I felt like I couldn't go right. All I wanted to do for 10 minutes was go right, and that guy was going left. And so he just went left, and he went left. And I felt like at one point I thought I'd turned around, but I think what I'd done is actually just turned the camera round, but I was still going left. And it was a well-animated left, but it was just left. And I was like, you know what? I want to go right, and this game's not for me.
When you compare this to, if they'd have taken this and played to the C64 strength, this could have been, you know, if you take something like this and then put it in the Impossible Mission engine, with that character, you know, you could have had that, you know, and actually control it with a joystick. You know, we have joysticks as standard on the C64, turning left, right, jumping stuff. We could do all that. These things can be done. You know, and I think that would have made it, well, it would have made it better.
It would have made it controllable. And I would argue, you know, last time in the podcast Zero, which will come out eventually, we spoke about the fact that that guy in Impossible Mission, just somersaulted everywhere. I would have happily had the guy turning like somersault. It would have just been a light relief from the pleasurely walk he was on, endlessly going wherever he was going and doing whatever he was.
Or the showing an axe to a monkey.
I can't believe you managed to pick something up. I walked past that many objects thinking, pick that up.
It's Q, I think.
I tried it all. In the end, I reached frustration point max.
It's funny because basically if you do it, you just lean forward with an axe and the monkey casually strolls past it and you're dead.
I am pretty sure in the annals of mythic Celtic folklore, monkeys don't feature heavily in it. I'm pretty sure of that.
No. I'm wondering sort of thing whether I pressed the present axe.
Oh, show sure monkey.
Because it certainly wasn't the attack.
Can you imagine if it was a text-based adventure? It would be, a monkey has surprised you. Show the monkey the axe. The monkey has beaten you.
Show axe to monkey. Monkey ignores axe. You are dead.
Exactly. So, you know, decontextualize the game and put it in another frame. It ain't going to work, is it? It's turn on nothing. It's rubbish.
No. Yeah.
Turn it off.
Turn on no. I think, yeah. Yeah, you're right. So we are okay. That's part one of our look at those games. These all these reviewed highly in Zap. Yeah.
Was it a sizzler or something? Oh my gosh!
It was a sizzler as far as I can. Let me just have a check.
Oh my gosh!
Turnanog was indeed a sizzler.
You know what? They must have been having something happy that day. I mean,
yeah. For those who don't know, if we mentioned these terminology sort of things, Zap had a rating system. If it was the best, I think. He got a gold medal, which was like, you know, you have to play this. Elite got the gold medal that month. Sizzler was something that got something between sort of 80%, you know, because they scored games out of 100%, 80 to 95 or something like that. And that was like, you really should go play this. And then they had some of the things that got, I think, under 40% or 35%, and they were called tackies. We'll come to them later. I think that's it for part one. we'll hopefully pick up some maybe... We've got more games to play, including the classic Tim Loves Cricket. So stay around for that. You didn't hear right. That is Tim Loves Cricket. That's coming up in part two. So we'll see you soon. All right, okay, welcome back. So that's after part one. We're going to this small interstitial section, and we're going to just quickly cover what was going on in the world in May 1985, primarily to do with the UK and what was going on in the news and anything sort of noteworthy. And I will give you a warning. This is not happy. So it seemed like the world of football was... but let's start sort of thing. May 4th, we had the 30th Eurovision Song Contest. You know, everyone likes Eurovision. And it was won by Sweden, by the Bobby Sox. It was in Sweden. It was won by Bobby Sox song, La Det Swing, for Norway.
If you're going to win the Eurovision Song Contest in 1985, you're going to win it with that. Norway as well. Was it in Norway? Or did Norway win?
No, it was in Sweden and Norway won.
Goodness me. They were always the rank outsiders. Where did, I wonder where we came in that one.
Probably, I don't know, probably 19, last.
We didn't do very well after, was it Bucks Fizz the last time? Well, no, we won with Katrina and the Waves, didn't we? That year.
We did win with Katrina and the Waves, yeah, many years later. Well, so football. Football, we had a very bad month. there was many things. There was the, for those who remember sort of thing, and obviously, you know, some people may remember this very badly sort of thing. There was the 56 people killed in the Bradford City Stadium fire. A 40-year-old boy was killed at, same day in Leeds United football hooligans right at Birmingham City. This was in the middle of May. I'm not going to comment on these sort of things. This is what was going on. It's like this kickstarted a lot of changes within football and everything like that. So, you know, think of what you want. And then just to further compound tragedy in the footballing world sort of thing, on the 29th of May, there was the Heysel Stadium disaster, the European Cup final between Liverpool and Juventus, where 39 football fans were died when a wall collapsed. So this was not good. You know, this is, to put it bluntly, sort of thing, this was a horrific series of events that changed a lot within football stadiums and would, you know, further compounded when Hillsborough happened sort of thing. So this is the time, the 1980s, where public safety was not, you know, the thing that it is now. We look at things now and things do seem a lot more safer, but back then it was you know, probably not the case. But I'm not here to lay blame. I'm not here to talk about those. That's what was going on.
Oh, it just changed football forever, right? I mean, you know, we'll go on about it, but I think it changed the way that football matches were run and the way they were manned by fans, and they changed the dynamic of that relationship for all time. It remains to this day changed, doesn't it? So
it does, yeah. And as if that weren't bad enough, scientists they announced the discovery of the hole in the ozone layer.
Yeah, that was always a bleak moment, wasn't it? And then it was, yeah, like, you're to blame. You used too many air fresheners and too many, you know, CFC products.
Yeah. So for those who don't know, in the 1980s, we had a penchant for using hairspray and deodorant that came in cans that had chlorofluorocarbons. I think were the CFCs, and they were great. They kept you smelling fresh. They kept your hair nice and stiff. But the problem was, sort of thing, is that they ate away at the ozone layer, which is a very important layer around the atmosphere of the Earth that blocks out the sun's rays, and a huge hole was found over the Arctic, I think it was. And so, you know, just like we're experiencing now with global warming and everything and the climate crisis we are in at the moment, this was one of the first big things to sort of bring that to people's attention. It was a huge, huge story sort of thing. There was this huge thing, and it led to essentially the banning of chlorofluorocarbons. I think they were used in, also they were in the back of, they were used in fridges as well, weren't they, if I remember rightly?
Yeah, it was used in certain gases. It was used in certain packaging even. You know, there was styrofoam, which was used by, at that time, in a lot of coffee cups and burger containers and all that kind of thing. That was produced with the same chemicals, and so that all had to change in order to reduce the size of the hole in the ozone layer, which I believe at the time we were told was the size of Australia or something like that. I remember it being the size of equivalent to some massive country, and everyone going, oh my gosh, I don't know what it actually is, but a hole in something sounds bad, sounds really bad. You know, you don't want a hole in the ozone layer. No one wants a hole in anything, but a hole in the ozone layer, goodness.
Yeah, it was a very big deal, and I do believe it. Is it still there? Is it gone now? Is it,
well,
sorted?
That's
it?
The mystery,
is it regrown?
I think they. I don't know if it's shrunk. I suppose, you know, what we could do is at some point is look it up and find out.
We could do. That would mean research. I just looked at what happened in the 80s in May 85, and it told me this happened, and that was the end of my job.
It hasn't made it hasn't made any news headlines recently, the ozone layer. It's been superseded by climate change, and I think it's just essentially, I think you're right, it was actually the very first indication that we had that the things that we did on the planet had a global impact on the environment that we were at that time completely oblivious to. And the fact that we were pumping all of the gases and everything else and using deodorants like crazy folk had somehow created this hole in the ozone. And for the first time, the human race was accountable for something that was damaging the planet en masse. And, you know, it made headlines because of that. And, you know, and things had to change, and they did. But it must have made a difference. I mean, it probably hasn't in the great scheme of things, because for every you know, for every CFC aerosol that we managed to change into some non-CFC one, you know, we cut down 9 million trees in the rainforest just to make up for that. So
yeah, I blame hair metal.
Well, yes, that was a lot of hairspray. Now, I suspect Los Angeles at the time when the hair metal was single-handedly responsible. Well, why was how the hole in the ozone layer wasn't there?
Yeah, that's true.
It migrated upwards.
It was all the smog.
Didn't notice. Yeah, they were too busy. But yeah, you're right. I mean, that was a lot of hairspray. That's But yeah, and it was. You know, for the first time, it was environmental news, which up to that point had been a non-thing, hadn't it? There hadn't been any. We never really heard about environmental news, though.
Not really. Not to sort of actually permeate the sort of bigger consciousness of people sort of thing. I mean, we were, 12, 13 at the time. Yeah. And I remember this was a thing that was on a lot, covered a lot. And there's a lot of people talking about it and what we need to do. It was a very big deal.
The funny thing is, right, in the 80s, as if we hadn't had enough doom and gloom, we'd spent most of the early, like we spoke about in episode zero, in 1982 and 1983, it was all nuclear war and doom and troubles. And then to compound that even further, it's you're destroying the ozone layer and there's these deadly viruses. And it's just this perpetual story of doom and gloom. And that actually is something that, as we go through the 80s with this podcast and the discovery of these things through the Zapped to the Past episodes, we'll see how, there's a theme, it's like a thread, a golden thread that runs through all of that, and we'll pick that up. But it was, like you say, the first time that a big global announcement of that kind had really hit the headlines, because, it was a hole in the ozone layer. At the end of the day, we'd done something bad.
Mm, absolutely. Very bad. So that was it. I mean, I'm sure there's lots of other things going on. I think there was a big march, or big sort of one of the big marches in the Kremlin, Red Square. They wandered past with all their ICBMs and what have you. That happened. Things were going on, obviously, but it there was, I think, as Graham says, there was a lot of, it was the start of things changing and the start of us sort of realizing, like I said, we were 13, starting to realize sort of thing that, our actions, spraying on too much brute, was damaging the ozone layer. Damaging the world.
Who knew? We didn't know.
No, we didn't. We were sold a product to make us smell nice.
Exactly, yeah. If I'd have known that, using the Lynx Africa would have actually destroyed parts of Africa, I would never have used it.
No. If my mum had hair that was so solid, you could, chip away at the ice in your freezer with it. She used so much hairspray.
Yeah,
I think it was a can of go.
Yeah. I'm pretty convinced the red was mashed potato at one point. It was like solid mass. But there you go. That's mum's spray. That's what they do.
Yeah. What price ozone layer?
Okay.
Anyway, on that note, let us progress into part two. Let's get back to the games. All right. Welcome back after that joyous news section. Let's move into some joyous games. Yeah, maybe. All right, what we got first? Okay, first up is the strangely titled Bounty Bob Strikes Back.
Yeah. Well, why strange? It's got a black guy called Bob in it.
What's he striking back at?
Yeah. Well, is this not a sequel? I thought this was a sequel to an original game.
Was it a sequel? Was it... What was the first one? Was it just Bounty Bob?
Yeah.
Oh, there you go then. I really have no recollection of a game called Bounty Bob. I'm sure there probably was. But in this, Bounty Bob was striking back, and he was striking back in a pretty standard pixel perfect Manic Miner style platformer, single screen platformer, with some interesting touches that some work and some don't. Like, it is perfect and it's very annoying. Sound effects are annoying. It's very easy to die by misjudging a jump because you think, oh, I'll land on that. No, you won't. And then you'll just continue downwards in a horrible diagonal until you hit the floor and die.
Yeah.
I'm sure you did that loads of times because I did it hundreds
Many
of times.
Times.
So the main mechanic that you have to do in Bounty Bob Strikes Back is you have to touch or walk over every single part of every platform on the screen to progress it. So it's not a case of just collecting some items. You've got to get to every part of the screen, of every platform, and walk on it. This changes it to a solid color from its dash color And once you've done that, you can progress to the next level. Some of the platforms are single squares. And you think, I can jump on that? And no, you can't. Oh, yes, you can. Only from a certain point. Who knows? There are some enemies walking around. You pick up random objects that allow you to walk into them and kill them. There are enemies that that populate the level that you can kill by collecting a random assortment of objects that then turn them into things that you can just walk into and kill, kind of Pac-Man-like. And that's it, really. I mean, you know, there's a teleporter on the very first screen, which takes you for no real reason. Teleports you to the top of the screen, where you then have to work your way down. Why not just start you at the top of the screen? I mean, unless teleporters come into it later, sort of thing. I'm going to be honest. The pixel perfectness put me off, and I couldn't get off the first screen because it was so tricky, sort of thing, and it's so hard. And you know, this had quite a decent reputation. People liked it, and I can see why. It does add a few new elements to that Manic Miner style of single screen platformer. But it's just too goddamn finicky and hard.
I mean, I felt exactly the same. This is very arcade inspired. So it's inherited arcade sounds and it's inherited arcade difficulty. Now, the problem with doing that on a home version is that, you know, the difficulty spike has to be something that you can get past. Because otherwise, no one's going to get off that first screen. And I like you never made it off the first screen. Because of the complex and crazy sprite detection collision, which seemed completely... It was inexplicable at times. So at certain points, it made sense. But like you say, you'd jump and suddenly you'd fly through a platform and you'd end up squashed. Or there was just... It didn't make a lot of sense. Now, this is a bit of a throwback, I think, too. It felt like playing a game called Miner 2049er or Miner 49er, which was an old Atari game from many moons back. So there's some hints of that kind of game. And in fact, when you hit the enemies and you die, you sort of expand and contract and sort of die that way. That's straight from Miner 49er. So I think this is basically a version of that. And it does have all of that kind, those kind of arcade-style tropes. But it is really annoying. And you have to really persevere with it and really want to persevere with it in order to get past. And I can't imagine how difficult Scream 2 is. If screen one is that hard,
there's 20 odd levels.
Yeah, and the thing is, there's actually a very clear game arc in Bounty Bob Strikes Back. So it's not like some other games where it's like there's going to be 100 screens. You are told from the get go there's this many screens. You've got to get through this many. The remit of the game is made clear, but you've got to get through those screens. And with three lives, I would argue that Impossible Mission is hard enough, but this is an impossible task. It's something that even a hardcore arcade player of some standing would have trouble navigating correctly those levels, and I think. And it does have those hints of the Manic Miner kind of feel, but it lacks the kind of, you know, it lacks any kind of personality in that way. It just feels like it is an arcade game, essentially, so it's very arcade. And that comes with, you know, the ability to make you want to put 10p's in.
Yeah, one thing I really did like, though, was the high score. The high score take that where you input your name with the two little things moving up left and right and pushing the things out and the space delete and then it all come out. And then the way the high score table was displayed with the little birds picking up the letters and putting them and shifting all the scores around and everything. That was like, that almost made the game worth playing just to see that screen. Because I thought that was excellent and probably must have taken longer to program, would have thought, than the actual game.
Well, they know you're gonna die a lot, right?
Yeah, but I was looking at it going, this is really clever. So these little birds would pick your name up and they would, if you were higher than the previous high score, they would fly to that and move those letters down. And it also, as well, if your name was the same, it didn't always move them around. It was clever enough to know that it didn't need to swap that digit. It could just put the new one in underneath it.
You're right. It feels like there was two programmers.
Yeah. Someone had a really cool high score system and they went, oh, just stick it on this game. I'm like, yeah. But yeah, I did enjoy that. So I like to find the positives where I can. And in this, it was simply getting a score so I could put some high score in.
Yeah, there was that moment when you actually achieved a score. And like, yes, good.
Yeah. And that was that. But yeah, it's you know, it is what it is, sort of thing. I'm sure people, if you like, and I hate to say this phrase, if you like the sort of thing, you might like it. But it is just a, and I think Miner 49 is a good call, actually. It does probably owe more to that than Manic Miner. So yeah, you know, just I think it's worth a play just to do. We have to play through two or three times just to get some scores on that high score and enjoy that.
Well, exactly. Well, this, and as we'll discover, there are many games that come along that follow a very similar kind of trope.
Absolutely.
You know, it's the early birth of platform games as such, and they'd vary. But at the end of the day, these early ones like that are the kind of the early benchmarks. And in actuality, later on, as we'll discover, the complexity of the tasks increases. But your chance of survival also increases because they realise that no one has fun. No one has any fun if you can't get off the first screen, right? So,
yeah, nobody. So yeah, one of those. Up next, let's move along. Up next, we've got Tim Loves Cricket.
Or right. Does he? Does he really?
Tim? I don't know who Tim was.
I think Tim Love is the person. It's Tim Loves Cricket.
Oh, is there an apostrophe in there?
Yeah.
All right.
It's not just a generic Tim.
I thought it was like Tim Brooke Taylor or something, someone from the Goodies.
I think Tim Love was a cricketer.
Timothy Mallet. I thought it was Tim Loves Cricket.
To be fair, that might have made it better.
Who's Tim? Oh, that makes a lot more sense. And I feel really stupid for not noticing that apostrophe.
Well, yeah, it'd be like anyway, Jeff Capes Cricket. So, it wouldn't be just Capes Cricket is some game that Jeff plays.
So, Tim Love, it's his cricket game. Right, okay. That all-important apostrophe is... it's not actually changed my thinking on the game, though, because it's ass. And it's, although my first statement on this is amazing for all the wrong reasons. Because you play it and it says, and I think at one point it says, do you actually want to play cricket? Which is a question. I'm like, well, what else am I going to do? This is a cricket game. But then it starts and it goes, do you want a ball? I chose to bat, which then treated me to the animation for the bowler. And I've never seen anything like it. I don't know whether my computer was running it fast or something like that, but there was two frames of animation running at such a pace that I don't know what was wrong with this bowler. But could you describe it?
Yeah, the word you're looking for was crap.
It's these two frames that flick together so fast that it's supposed to look like, you know, someone running from behind. But then as they get near to the crease to do the bowl, it freezes into one frame of animation, and they skid to the crease and bowl. Then the ball comes towards you, and you're the crappiest batter ever. Who I don't know where I couldn't bat. And I moved forward at one point, and it went to the fielding, and then I couldn't see what was going on. And then just went, "Oh, you've been run out." Like, what did I do? I haven't done anything. So that's just garbage, utter garbage. I mean,
absolutely.
Cricket games obviously were unusual, probably, and, you know, Tim Love was probably happy to get some money from this. But, oh, God, dreadful.
Yeah.
Dreadful.
I put in my notes for this, Tim may never love cricket again after he sees this horrific monstrosity. It felt like it had been, it felt to me like it was one of those that we spoke about earlier. I felt like it was typed in, like from a magazine, like somebody, this was like a listing that someone typed in and released.
Yeah, and didn't realise they've got lots of date checksum errors.
Yeah, exactly. Somehow it ran, but nobody knows how. It felt to me like if you like cricket, you would never want to play this game because it's not something. I thought it would make cricket. If there's anything that can make cricket worse, and I'm not a cricket fan, but I get that people like it. But this is just something that would take that experience and ruin it in every possible way. It felt like it had. It felt like it was written in BASIC, which I think it probably was actually. So it had that because there was no way that was machine code that was running that. It didn't have the vibrancy and the fidelity and the speed of machine code. This was something that was, I'm pretty sure, was written BASIC. And that might mean that it was written by some 14-year-old kid who, you know, some 14-year-old savant cricket fan who thought, you know, who loved Tim Love and thought, you know, I'm going to make a cricket game about, you know, and you could choose it. You could do all the things you should be able to do in cricket. Choose your team, bat, bowl, field, whatever. But, you know, unless you really, really like cricket, you are going to hate this game. Because as soon as you see that bowler, such as he is, appear and then, you know, go through what can only be described as a painful episode and experience of some kind of torturous fit in order to throw the ball. It just felt, you know, why would you do that? You know, it would have been better to not have that and just go, the bowler has thrown the ball, you know, in some kind of text. No, and as if, to, you know, even the idea of a text-based cricket game, that makes me shiver with horror. it would be nothing compared to that sequence where that bowler inexplicably left-righted his way across the screen and somehow threw the ball in the right direction. And my batter, as with yours, just went, no, you missed. I'm thinking, yeah. Well, you know, I actually chose to auto-choose the team at the beginning because you can choose to name it, which would have taken far too long in that process. Mm-hmm. I chose to sort of let it pick the names. But what it did was not just pick the names, pick the worst batting side in known cricket history. Because these guys didn't move, they just kind of stood there while this... But then again, I think to myself, if this was a real cricket match and you were ready to bat and you stood at the crease, with, you know, and then you see that thing running towards you... You know, this blur of blocks flies towards you and just hurls a ball at you. You think, ah! And you wouldn't know what to do. So I think you would be frozen in terror. So it may be, in actuality, it's a very accurate description of what would happen if a cricket batter was terrified beyond the capacity for rational thought. And if that's the case, if it's a cricket terror simulator, it was very good.
Absolutely.
In every other capacity, it's a cricket game, bad.
That's actually made me reconsider my thoughts on Tim Loves Cricket. yeah, I also like how your answer to making anything better is to make it text-based. This was a turn a knob. Make it text-based. Just make them text-based. Elite. Just have them flying around space. Just, you have flown to space.
Well, don't
you have hit a car.
Just everything don't have the complexity unless you're ready. You're right. But in this instance, I would take out the cricket bowling in Elite. Don't make me dock, you know, don't make me do that. And in these other games, you know, turn and off, don't make it happen, just switch it off.
As you said, turn it off.
Yeah, turn and off, turn it off. But in this particular instance, I put Tim doesn't love cricket, and he certainly doesn't know what cricket's about. In fact, I would argue all he knows really is that there's a ball and a bat involved, and there's something in between, which for me looked like a wasp that had been squashed and thrown across the screen. So
it's not good. No,
horrible was my last word on that game. Horrible.
Yeah. Not. It wasn't. Yeah. Tim, no. No cricket. No. No, let's move on. Let's move on to something just as impenetrable as cricket. Super Huey. So, Super Huey's from Paul Norman. I didn't know Paul Norman made this.
Okay.
Hot on the Heels of Forbidden Forest. He turns his... we got another helicopter game. Two helicopter games in one episode. Who would think that the Commodore 64 was replete with helicopter games? Well, here you go. Here's your second. This is very, very different to Airwolf. No caves. In fact, when I played it, no flying. Because I couldn't barely get off the floor. Super Huey... So you're essentially, it's more like a simulator. So you're in the cockpit of a Super Huey, which is, you know, a combat helicopter from, you know, the American Army, and you are given control of it. And the way you control it is by writing a series of three-letter codes.
Just when you thought the Turn-O-Nog ruled the roost on inexplicable control systems, then you come across Super Huey.
Yeah. Okay. This does undermine your argument that turning everything into a text adventure makes it better, because this is essentially a text adventure helicopter sim, and it didn't make it better.
No.
And coming from, I mean, it's got some nice visual. You know, visually it's okay. The interior looks all right, sort of thing. But I don't know whether, you know, on the back of Forbidden Forest, he was like, it's a strange one to go to, haunted forest. You know, hardcore sim of an American chopper. I can't see the through line, but it is what it is. They were experimenting clearly with you know, control systems of what would work, trying to get around the single joystick and a button. But three word commands that you had to remember?
No.
Like,
no,
what?
No.
No. I could remember POW for power. And then if you typed them wrong, you still had to keep typing until you got back to the start of the three letters. It's a confusing mess of a thing. And again, inexplicably, got a sizzler.
Yeah, now, there's a couple of things to note there. One, how did that happen?
And how was one of the commands,
were they,
I think.
Were they playing the same game? I don't understand. Maybe not. I don't know. For me, what made me laugh most of all, and if you go right back, as soon as the opening sequence for the game, which has got this kind of really stirring music score, and it's really kind of, it's got like opening credits for this game, like this superhero graphics kind of spin on and fly off in some, you know, in a very early blocky motion graphics kind of sense. It has a title sequence for a game. Okay, I get that. And a Huey helicopter-ish kind of flies up, and there's a pilot in there, and it's all very, you know, winky-faced, I'm in a helicopter pilot, and then it takes ages to load after that. So that's one load of stuff. Now, 64Ks worth of intro happens and goes away. Then the game starts, and you're presented with the cockpit, and it's like, right, fly. And you've got the controls, and it's like, okay, so I've got to start the engine, so that's PPT. Then I've got to, you know, well, fuel, FP6. And it's just, what on earth made him think that, instead of just pressing the fire button on a joystick and up, wouldn't be the best way to start that game? And I get that it's a, you know, it's going for simulation, but I'm pretty sure that there is not in every Super Huey helicopter in the world a QWERTY keyboard, which means that's how you fly it. And I'm pretty sure of that. So why that control system? And that's what really frustrated me. I felt this had the makings of something, and I don't like flight simulators, let's be honest. So I felt that maybe it was more shooter. The intro kind of sold it as a kind of a shooting game. So maybe it had that logic about it. But I never managed to get it in the air for more than a second before exploding. Which is, you know, and I think that's probably because I pressed the wrong key combo. My feeling was every time I must have pressed the explode the helicopter in desperation key code.
Yeah.
But I mean, why do that?
If you think about it sort of thing, there was what was the control? There was what, 20 odd commands or something like that? There are more than, you know, 40 keys on that keyboard. You only need to assign each key to a command. I don't need to type in POW for power. Just press the P button.
Well, this is
press
it, but I think that was what he was aiming for, complex simulation. So, and I think that's what he was aiming for. So it needed to feel complex to launch that, because helicopters are complicated. You know, in a helicopter, you've got two joysticks all the time. You've got, you know, you've got, obviously you've got your up and down, and you've got your left and right, or rotate, and all the rest of it. No, I'm not a helicopter pilot, and I probably just insulted every helicopter pilot in the world by saying it's those two things. But my understanding is that it is complicated to fly a helicopter, but if you're making a game about flying a helicopter, the whole point is that you don't over-simulate, and by doing that, ruin the experience of what could have been quite interesting. And even when you got off the ground, and I checked out some YouTube videos because I couldn't actually get much further than an explosion off the ground. So I checked out some videos of the game playing, and it, you know, you do take off, you've got a kind of a sky ground view, there are sprites in there that kind of, you can, you know, go left and right in the screen, you know, pictures and yours, and that kind of way you would expect a helicopter to do, and you've got sound effects and all the rest of it, and I don't doubt that there's a lot of programming prowess involved in to make that happen in that kind of way at this time, and its ambition to make a simulator of an aircraft is 1985 is crazy. And as we'll discover later down the line, you know, this is something that would repeatedly come back into the C64 and video games. This idea of simulating something, and it reaches its apex with things like Gunship and things like that. But you know, this is an early version of an attempt at that. So I applaud the attempt, but I think, you know, if you're going to do this, you've got to make these games penetrable. And these 1985 games, this list, they all suffer from that similar problem. They seem to suffer from being impenetrably... And like you say, I think they were just experimenting with controls. I think you're right. I think that's a really salient point. I think they didn't quite have it right. And this one has it wrong so badly that it... You know, I've never flown a Super Huey helicopter, and I'm still never going to be able to. You know, never.
No, not with those controls. If I got into a Super Huey and there's a keyboard in front of me and it said type three-letter commands in, and I would take everything back. yeah. everything.
Oh, wait, you know. I know this.
Absolutely. Oh, be like the girl in Jurassic Park. Yeah, yeah. It's a Unix system.
It's a Unix system. I know this. POW, power. It makes sense. But I was the thing. Why wouldn't up just be UP? Up. If you're in a helicopter.
Because it's not three letters.
What just seemed, you know, up, I suppose down would have to be, you know, it just seemed odd. But you've got cursor keys on a Commodore 64 keyboard, so that, for me, would be up and down. Don't, you know what? Don't leave the controls to me, a novice.
Yeah.
Super Huey pilot. Leave it to the experts who make these games in 1985 to make sure I know. It's the same logic that makes cricket impossible to enjoy anyway, even though this is the same way flying a helicopter is so difficult, put me off for life. Never want to be a cricket or a helicopter pilot again.
And so making it a text adventure did not work.
Can you imagine a helicopter flight simulator as a text adventure? Up, you are now up. Down, you have gone down. Hover, you are hovering. Rotate left. You can see more off the left than you did when you didn't rotate left. I mean, how would you describe that? You are rotating. Yeah. Stop rotating. You have stopped. Stop. Propellers.
Stop.
Bad.
Beep,
beep,
stop.
Bad idea. Anyway, enough. Yeah.
You have
stop
crashed.
Stop playing. You have crashed. Yeah, literally.
Right. So, yeah, Super Huey. So, yes, Super Huey. No. Nope, nope, nope. Right, what we got next on our list? A few more before we hit media. So let's move on to Cauldron.
I like Cauldron.
Tell us why.
So, So it's a bit of a combination of two things. There is faults. I'm not going to say there isn't, but at the same time, it looks different. It looks like a nice game. There's a atmosphere and a feel to Cauldron, which is something that gets picked up in its sequel later, but there's a feel to it. There's a nice atmosphere to the game. It is hard, crazy hard to do. And that part is perhaps its main failing is that it's ridiculously difficult, but you know, it's got some really great atmosphere sound. Its music is good. Its sounds are good. The graphics are really nicely drawn. It's, you know, its backgrounds when you're in the main part where you're the witch flying through and you got the sort of the, you have to go into the caves and stuff like that, which is kind of a shoot 'em up really. Those parts are really good. It is quite hard to fly and land. And then you're in the caves and again you're kind of almost in the sort of Bounty Bob territory with the sprite, you know, collision being precise. But I quite like Cauldron. I quite like that Cauldron series of games. There's a lineage to it and an atmosphere, and it's something a little bit different. It's how I imagine Attic Attack and those Spectrum games should have been done on a Commodore 64 in terms of the way the graphics look and the feel of it. It's a Palace game, and Palace had a really good tradition of doing, as we'll discover later down the line, some really great games. So I think it was the beginning of a good heritage for them, but it does have that difficulty spike, and that is, you know, it does make it, that's the one thing that really sets it back and mars it, I think. But other than that, it's a quite pretty looking game. I don't remember what review it got on Zap, actually. I can't remember.
It was a Sizzler.
It sort of has that kind of Sizzler look. But it's not a Sizzler in the sense that, you know, you've got to really persevere with Cauldron, I think, and get good at it. And I'm not sure how good you could ever be at it, really. But that's my take. What about you?
Yeah, no, I think I'd echo most of that. I think it is very pretty looking. It's unusual looking. It's got an unusual setting. It has, influences from something like Defender, and it's side-scrolling left to right. You can flip back and forth. And the introduction of the weird platforming sections is quite nice. That being a witch, and the landscapes are really nicely drawn. The scrolling's nice and smooth. Like you said, I think Palace have a reputation for knocking these kind of games out, and they would continue to do so with Cauldron 2, Antiriad, Barbarian, Rib Runner, I think, all these kind of games that came from them sort of thing. They had a particular look. I think they had a really good central sort of artist and musicians. And I think they had a good sort of solid base around them. It is far too hard. It's too finicky to control. It's never particularly easy to things flying at you to control, shooting up, down, and centrally, and to land, and it's controls let it down. which is a thing I think we see at this point in time, as we've mentioned already, that a tighter control scheme would have benefited this game hugely, and I think made it into something really quite special, because I think it is a really nice looking game, but it's like they just didn't quite nail that the feel of what would come later and get, say, something like, once you get control of it, something like Whizball, where it feels tight and nice to control and it's got a bit of inertia and it feels good. It's just a bit lacking here. Or it's something like Drop Zone. Archie MacLaine's Drop Zone, I think, was much better. That's what really just pulls this down slightly, sort of thing. But I'm all for the setting, I'm all for the visuals, I'm all for the atmosphere, and I'm all for the way, you know, they've tried to do something else with it. And, you know, from your bog standard run-of-the-mill arcade conversion, they've taken what were, you know, typical game tropes at the time and made it into something, you know, different. And I think quintessentially quite British as well.
Yeah, and I think the controls in their games plagued Palace.
Yes, they did.
They had a problem, you know, there was, and we'll come to this as we go through all of the various apps and we cover their games. But, you know, this is not an isolated incident in terms of the Palace releases, and certainly not for Cauldron. But there's other games as well that suffer. And they have that also, a lot of the games have that really weird difficulty spike about them as well. But that said, I agree with you. There's a look about their games. They look really nice. There's, you know, you've got really well-defined graphics and sprites. You've got really nice, they always have an opening sequence, so the game feels like it has a beginning and a start, and it sets the pace and the atmosphere for the game. And there's little animations in the game that do that. So when you land, you know, and you can go in your cottage and she can steer the car, and all those little things that those games do that you kind of take for granted now in games, that they have those kind of sequences. But back then, that what they're classed as are really, they are like mini little cutscenes, even though they're very, very rudimentary. That's what they are. And you know, and it sticks out. And I think that's in a sea of, because obviously we saw in the previous podcast, there's a sea of games out. There's hundreds of games out. Now, we've just looked at the ones that made it into Zap, obviously. But there's loads of them that never made it because they were kind of not very good or anything else. So there's a lot of stuff going on. And to stand out, you needed to be... Now, if you take out the license conversions in the arcades, you needed to have a thing. And Cauldron had that thing, even if it was just a witch and she was on a broom. And, you know, it had its own world, its own gameplay, its own... space. It created that kind of world, and because it had its own game world and its own game logic, albeit crazy difficult, it made a lot more sense, and it felt like a much more a comprehensive game. It felt there's a similar game experience on the BBC Micro, weirdly enough, not the same as Cauldron, but there's a game called Citadel, which again is a game that's rudimentary in graphics but is in its own space, has its own world logic, and because of that makes sense in that. And Cauldron does make sense in its own game world. You just have to accept that you're going to die a lot when you play that game because it's so hard. But
that is true.
But I think it owes a little bit to the Ultimate games. There's hints of Ultimate games about the Cauldron and the Palace games. The way you shoot, it feels very much like Attic Attack and very much like those kind of games. The way you sort of press the button, directionally shoot your sort of spells when you're flying through the air, and that kind of the way that you can take damage from things and stuff, you know, those are hints of other games that have led to that. But it's an achievement in programming as well on a Commodore 64. It stands head and shoulders above some of the other games that we've looked at in terms of its graphics. And when we spoke earlier about, you know, Turn Our Rubbish and the graphics that were just ported from a Spectrum, and then if you compare that side by side to the graphics that are in Cauldron, you know, you can see there is a core difference between the colourful screens and graphics of the medium res and that binaural monochromatic colour style that elides all of that. So, for me, it's a great game, but marred by its difficulty. But that is something that is going to come back to haunt them.
Yeah, I think spot on. Yeah, good stuff. Yeah, I think you're right. It's all right. It's okay. But yeah, too hard.
Way too hard. Yeah.
As ever. I knew it was. Right, yeah, so Cauldron. Sort of a partial thumbs
yes,
up.
Yes.
We don't get many of them tonight.
No.
This one.
No. Shadowfire and Cauldron right. So far are the two that stick out.
Yeah. And we're not going to get another one right now. And there we go. That's the end of part one for issue one. We've looked at Elite, Spy Hunter, Pole Position, Airwolf, Turner Nog, Bounty Bob, Tim Loves Cricket, Super Huey, and Cauldron. As I'm sure you will agree, some much better than others. Some disappointments, some eye-openers, and I'm sure it'll just carry on like that. In our next episode, we'll be carrying on reviewing games, looking at games from that first, from May 1985. We'll be looking at games such as Give My Regards to Broad Street, Lords of Midnight, Penetrator, and Buck Rogers, along with some others as well. It don't get very good. So expect many levels of awful in the next part. I've been Adrian Mills. I've been joined by Graham Raddings. Thanks for listening to Zap to the Past, and we will catch you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Zap to the Past podcast. We hope you enjoyed our deep dive into the world of Commodore 64 games, as well as the music, sights, sounds and news from around the 1980s, driven, of course, by the issue of Zap 64 magazine published at the time. We will be back next week with another podcast, so do please join us. Until then, please head over to zaptothepast.com to sign up to our email list, as well as check out all the links and resources in the show notes. You will also find us on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram under Zap to the Past. The Zap to the Past podcast is written and produced by Adrian Mills and Graham Raddings and recorded at Flaky Bits 2.0 Studio. All opinions expressed are those of the writers, and while we indeed love Zap 64 magazine, the Zap to the Past podcast is not affiliated with it in any way. Stay safe and see you next time.